Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
New rules have taken effect for procurement from Ability One contractors. Those are the companies, mostly nonprofits, whose employees have disabilities. The rules were ordered by Congress back in 2017, and they do bring some more competition into the program. Joining me with an update, the executive director of the Ability One Commission, Kim Zike. Ms. Zike, good to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
So what's going on with my old tried and crude Ability One program? Tell us about the new rules and what they require of agencies now going ahead with the procurement from the Ability One contractor set.
The Ability One program provides employment opportunities to individuals who are blind or have significant disabilities through the federal acquisition system. Historically, the Ability One program has been an exception to competition in contracting. So the U.S. Ability One Commission announced a new final rule supporting competition in the Ability One program. It is limited competition, and we'll talk about that, but it does deliver on a top priority of that congressional oversight panel.
Right, because of the wage structures and the nonprofit, I believe, status of many of the companies, you don't want them chasing lower and lower prices all the time. And yet you want competition. So how does it actually work then?
The final rule strikes a balance between those important objectives, between meeting our government customers' expectations for best value on Ability One contracts. At the same time, the final rule helps us advance the Ability One mission by taking into account employment and career mobility for individuals with disabilities as factors in the competition.
And how does it do that? What are some of the strictures now that agencies have to follow?
A typical competition involves, of course, technical proposals, past performance, and consideration of price. So when the Ability One Program Commission approves a competition, these will be limited to the largest contracts in the Ability One program. The commission will consider those factors, but at the same time, the commission will consider and reward what we call mission-related factors, or the social impact of the Ability One employer. So that means the commission will look at training, it will look at career mobility, and it will look at the overall employment opportunities that an Ability One provider brings to the table, in addition to, again, the traditional competitive factors.
Well, does the commission stand in between the requisitioner, the acquiring agency, and the contractors?
The commission will have an important oversight role. The commission will approve a request for competition. Those will be limited. One of the safeguards that we have built into this rule is who can request a competition. So that will come from a high level in the organization, in the customer organization. That will come from a senior executive or a general officer. The commission will look at our suitability criteria before approving a competition. And then the commission will ensure, again, a balance of factors, so technical, past performance, price, and that social impact that we will look at in terms of the career opportunities for people with disabilities.
And do you expect most of the requests for competition to come from, say, the Defense Department?
Well, the Department of Defense is the largest Ability One customer. The Department of Defense has been requesting the opportunity to have competition, so we foresee some requests will come from DOD. At the same time, we have a lot of civilian agencies who are our customers as well. And so the final rule, in fact, takes that into account. It sets a dollar threshold for DOD that is different from our civilian customers. So only, again, the largest Ability One contracts, whether coming from defense customers or civilian, will be eligible for competition.
What are those dollar thresholds?
The threshold for defense contract is $50 million total contract value. So that's $10 million annual value. For our civilian customers who tend to have smaller contracts, it's a $10 million total contract value threshold. So $2 million per year.
Got it. And these are often not high priced types of items that they're buying. I mean, there are items in Ability One, but there's also services too, correct?
And the competition rule applies specifically to Ability One service contracts. So we perform a wide range of services. Where I see the competition rule coming into play would be your large base support operations contracts, where Ability One may handle the public works for an entire military installation. Could also come into play for some of our civilian contracts where we have perhaps total facilities management of a large building complex.
We're speaking with Kim Zeik. She is executive director of the Ability One Commission. And what has been the reaction so far, or the acceptance of this, not that they have much choice, on those services contractors?
The final rule that was just published March 22nd, and it reflects extensive stakeholder engagement. It directly responds to, I would say, adopts and adapts the public comments that we received. So the commission expects our stakeholders to feel more comfortable with the final rule than they did with the proposed rule. We heard a lot of feedback. We've taken about a year since the initial rule was proposed to go through all of those comments, all of those recommendations, and to come out with a final rule that we think achieves the balance all of our stakeholders are looking for, whether they're customers or Ability One employers.
So you got comments from the Ability One companies and also from the federal agencies?
Correct. We received well over 100 comments. We had listening sessions in addition to the opportunity for the public to submit written formal comments. And those were taken into account. So the final rule, I would say, was informed by and improved by the public comments.
Now, this, I understand, was ordered up by Congress in the NDAA back in 2017. What took so long?
You're absolutely right. The 2017 National Defense Authorization Act established an oversight panel to recommend improvements in the Ability One program. So the panel took about 4 years to make a large number of recommendations and to review the commission's progress in implementing the recommendations. And the panel reached its sunset point a couple of years ago. We began working on this rulemaking process. The notice of proposed rulemaking was published about a year ago. So establishing regulations is a time-consuming process, particularly if you have broad comment, you know, and public outreach process, which the commission sought to implement here. And probably rulemaking should take time. I would say the rulemaking process worked the way it's supposed to in this case, because we did listen to the stakeholders and adopted and adapted so many of their comments in the final regulation.
And how does this all square this idea of competition, and there is a price element in there, when the Ability One, as I understand it, contractors are on a drive, if you will, to get wages up to the minimum wage level, which has been kind of a sticking point for the people that are employed, because they are people, even though they have disabilities. And so more and more of them are receiving at least the federal minimum wage. So wages are generally higher. Can this all square?
It does all square. It is all part of how the commission has been working to modernize the Ability One program. For the past year, we've been pleased to say that everyone in the Ability One program working on Ability One contracts will earn no less than the federal minimum, state minimum wage, or the prevailing wage, which on federal contracts tends to be much higher. Our average wage in the Ability One program is over $18 an hour on our Ability One service contracts. And the competition rule applies within and among Ability One employers. So we have a level playing field. Everyone who will be subject to or eligible to compete in a competition will be paying the same wages.
Understood. Okay. Yeah, that is an important development. And what about modernizing in terms of the range of disabilities? You mentioned blindness first, and I think that's kind of the grandfathered in condition that gave rise to Ability One. But in performing services, facilities, maintenance, janitorial type of stuff, then probably blind people can't do a lot of that type of work. So the range of disabilities incorporated, has that also been expanding?
The Ability One program does serve a very diverse population among those who are blind, visually impaired, or have significant disabilities. So many of our program employees, and I would say there are almost no limits to what individuals who are blind, visually impaired, or have significant disabilities can do within the program. But we certainly have a population that encompasses people with intellectual or developmental disabilities, individuals who may have mental health disabilities, as well as those with physical disabilities, hearing loss or deafness, just a very broad range of disabilities. And what we see on these large Ability One contracts, there's often an opportunity to employ people with a very diverse set of skills to provide them with the supports and services they need to be successful on the job.
Kim Zeik is Executive Director of the Ability One Commission. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
And we'll post this interview along with a link to the rule at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is, what do they need when they need it? And building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm gonna go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I wanna hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with an intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency, and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.